Have a guess where we are.
Today we're in Dublin at HubSpot, meeting the MD of the EMEA region for this great company, Mark Barry. We spent a full hour sitting down with him, having a chat all about the future of marketing, specifically looking at elements of positioning, elements of AI, and elements of leadership. It was a really reassuring, enjoyable chat where I just came out of it feeling quite relaxed, which is really, really nice.
We then had a tour by their head of culture, who really gave us a window into what it's like to work in a building like this or in an organisation like this. You know, Mark touched on culture and how important it was, but actually that just became a theme that has kind of threaded the entire day together for us. And so hopefully you'll see some of this and learn a bit more about HubSpot.
Cheers.
You know, we just want you to be yourself in that sense. Yeah. So lots of inappropriate questions coming your way.
We have a 30-second interview with Mark Barry, where 10 seconds are him introducing his name and title.
Yeah. And the rest is him walking out. Yeah.
The rest is him asking us to leave. Yeah.
We'll do that.
That buzzer under the desk here just...
Yeah. Security. Yeah.
Last night we were watching a video. I think it was one of the interviews you did with Startup Grind a few years ago.
Okay.
And... You introduced it saying that you had dreams of becoming a rock star. So, you know, can you speak to that? Because I'd love to know the journey.
Yeah, so past tense is the wrong tense. You know, have aspirations to be a rock star. I'm only slightly tongue-in-cheek on that. I mean, the family business, if you like, where I grew up, we're musicians, we're dancers, writers, actors, and I am the kind of the odd one out with a career in business. Mm-hmm. I kind of tripped into that, and for a while early in my career, I was a semi-professional musician, so I'd play guitar and go to different places with bands, mm-hmm. not just turning up, but you know, actually playing, and it was great. It was really fun. I particularly liked, you know, enjoyed writing music and doing original stuff. That wasn't the stuff that paid the bills, but that was really fun. But there's a point at which, as well, you're thinking, okay, well, the rent has to be paid. So how does that happen? You know, and so I drifted into proper jobs, you know, starting with you know, a kind of a telesales gig, which I did, which was memorable, and then into a customer service role in a mobile telco, and you know, gradually into other jobs as I became more kind of embedded in that side of the career. And so the aspiration to be a rock star, it's never died. It's just, you know, I'm busy at the moment doing this other stuff, you know.
Yeah. I love that.
It's so interesting that performance element is that the rock star that you're bringing into the business each day, or
I guess you'd have to ask the audience really if that comes through. I think though there's an introversion extroversion question, if you like, that comes into play if you're in a customer facing role or in a sales role, which is that there needs to at least be a portion of your time where you get energy from being around other people, you know, and it's not completely binary, right? But I think that's kind of important. I think the performance element, if you like, or that ability to maybe relate to people, or that ability to tell an interesting story, or just have a fluid conversation, some of that comes through training and practice, and you know, performance training, or even, you know, amateur training of being on stage. That is something that gets developed, you know. So I definitely think it's part of it. I think for me, where again, not to overstate the success of my music career, but the kind of the high you get from being on stage, and the high doesn't come from like playing amazingly. That's actually pretty sad, you know. The high comes from reaction, from people, you know, getting into it, or maybe you know, singing along or whatever. Like that's the rush, you know, the maybe slightly sad middle-aged part of where I get that rush now is standing up in front of customers or standing up in front of teams and, you know, and having a moment where you can share ideas and get some feedback. Performance element is still there, you know.
The difference in, so I struggle a little bit to run the webinars because we'll have, say, 1,000 people each week on a webinar. So you see the number and you're talking to a guest, but I'm just talking to one person on a screen. Mm. Whereas if we have at one of our meetups, maybe 70, 80 people in a room, I'm like looking for that person just found that funny. And then there's a little rustle of laughter. And then I'm like, and then it starts to kind of feed me. And whereas you get some people that like, oh no, comfortable on the screen, hate standing in front of people. Right. Whereas I don't know, I think the old school part of me is just like,
good together,
yeah, right? Like Jay likes the screen. I like the people. It's like, it's funny how you get feedback in different ways.
Yeah, I think, I mean, even on the screen, and again, it is the constant need for approval in me. I don't know what it is, but you know, I look for that feedback. You know, Zoom is great actually, you know, and tools like that are great where you will get a reaction or somebody might post an emoji or something like that. But I try, because we're in this world now, you know, it's not just the kind of the broadcast, you know, aspect that comes with you know, webinars and things like that, but we're in this world now in work. You know, it's not possible actually for me to have the entire team in a room, maybe once a year when we do a kickoff, but we can't do that, you know. And so, adapting to that format where you're both physical and virtual, probably sometimes at the same time, is the evolution of the art a little bit, you know, kind of having to lean into that, embrace that, get good at that. Again, I won't claim to have mastered that, but I think it's part of work and life today. You know, we've crossed that
threshold.
Rubicon, yeah. We're not going back.
No, you're right. I was actually watching the Taylor Swift documentary the other day because, you know, I'm cool.
Tay-Tay's life.
But she was speaking about that validation piece, you know, and that piece from the crowd. But I think you're spot on. It's about moving with the times as well and sort of acknowledging that's where it is. We'll definitely come to that in a minute because, like, we're in such a fascinating time, you know, as frankly, humanity, you know, but also in marketing with the changes that are going on, particularly in the tech sort of space.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ground us in HubSpot as well, because like it's an incredible space we're in today. I mean, it's just beautiful, but it's also just it had such an impact on the marketing world, you know, the world that we speak to all the time. And one of the elements that I was really interested in is that I counted 6 hubs, you know, for HubSpot. Mm. And we had this feedback from the community as well, which is like, HubSpot has become this platform for marketing, for sales, for all sorts of things. I mean, as a positioning challenge, that's huge. That must be so fascinating as a company to try and take on that as a positioning, to be that Swiss Army knife and sort of say, we are all of this, but also we are specifically this.
Yeah.
So from a marketing perspective and internally, how do you even begin to sort of think about that?
It's a fascinating challenge to think about. And if you think about the, you know, the foundations of HubSpot and the evolution of HubSpot, the creation of inbound marketing, the evolution of kind of the flywheel, and that approach to engaging customers, that is the kernel of what we do. It is the, as search is to Google, you know, inbound is to HubSpot. But increasingly what happens if you're successful, and thankfully we've had great success in that category, leading that category, is loyal customers ask for other things,
right,
and need other things. And our job is to listen to that and evaluate that and figure out, okay, are those interesting things to work on? Do we have the capability to do that? Do we have the desire to do that? Is there an opportunity for us to do that? And so, and that manifests as here are 6 hubs or 8 hubs or 10 hubs or whatever. But the ambition really is that we are, that HubSpot is a place where you can run the entire customer facing element of your business from one place. Mm-hmm. And that, and marketing is a really important part of that, but that's not the only part of that. You know, we need to talk to our prospects. We need to, you know, enable our sales teams to do that. We need to be able to engage with our loyal customers and, you know, create a service environment for that to happen. And so that evolution has been, I won't speak for our product leadership in how those ideas kind of evolved, but I think there's a degree of kind of organic growth that mm-hmm. comes with building the adjacencies around the core. Mm-hmm. And I think we were talking earlier actually about, you know, companies, you know, like Microsoft, where you know, maybe the core is obvious, and then you see something which is really non-adjacent, but that company is doing that thing, and it's kind of like, oh, that's odd. Yeah. you know, or like Amazon, you know, a bookseller, you know, all of a sudden being a cloud business, that feels odd, you know. Our approach is not that per se. We're building around that core. Not to say that, you know, we don't get into the self-driving car business at some stage in the future. I think that's pretty unlikely. Yeah. But actually, you know, but those adjacencies, I think, are pretty obvious. So I think where the idea of being, or the imperative, if you like, to keep at pace and stay ahead, is when you see emerging technologies, right? When you see other things come in that disrupt the space, you know, that organic growth, if you like, or that the building of those adjacent things around the core, again, I think is pretty obvious. It's pretty intuitive. You can reason it, but then you have something like AI that comes along and says, AI here, you know, now what, you know, and you want to be ahead of that, you know. The kind of like the last paradigm shift that has been anything as disruptive as that is Nokia running the world's most famous and useful and beloved mobile phone technology until the iPhone.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. The smartphone had existed before the iPhone, but Apple did it right.
Yeah. I feel like we've got the hook for the video. AI here. It's like, that's going right at the beginning. That will be the thing. I'm always listening for a hook. I was like,
that's funny. Yeah, it's so true. I mean, you know, so, you know, in our research, we sort of saw that you were working at a company which eventually was acquired by Vodafone. Mm. And this was 1999, I think you introduced it. By the way, you do not look like you've been working since like.
So I started my career at 9 years old in customer service in Vodafone.
That's fabulous.
I mean, your like, paper round was not very good. Yeah,
it was downhill, down the steepest hill that I've ever seen in my life. Yeah, if I look like you when I've been working since 1999, then fair play, you know. But you spoke about working for a company back then, and like there is that transformational shift because you were speaking about introducing e-commerce to this company at the same time as mobile tech was becoming more ubiquitous and stuff like that. And so, like, how do you reflect, because we are going through this generational shift now with AI and stuff like that, when you look back on the things that you learn in terms of your own development or how a company can kind of react to this sort of stuff?
Yeah.
From a trait perspective, a characteristic perspective, how do you even begin to think about like living in this transitional phase and sort of making the most of it, so to speak?
I think it kind of goes back to that rock star thing. You know, when I was 15, I wanted to be a rock star, you know. And when I was 20, I still wanted to be a rock star, but I then had other responsibilities and I needed a job to underpin that. When I was 25, still wanted to be a rock star, had a different job, a bigger job, you know, a mortgage at that stage, 30 years old, you know, still wanted to be a rock star. The point I'm trying to make is across all of those different phases, those different transitions, the world of work, the world of just how we live changed through primarily through technology, but then a bunch of other like crises that happened, the dot-com boom, financial collapse, pandemic. And the for me at least, I think the thing that has helped me navigate my career is in some ways to always know that I have this passion for this thing over here. Again, I don't really want to overstate that. It sounds like I'm obsessed about being a rock star, but there are things that I am passionate about, you know, that drive me. And music is one of those things, but family is one of those things. Curiosity is one of those things. Doing new things is one of those things. And had I been the type of person that had said, in 1995 or 1996, I want to be an accountant, then today, however interesting this would be for your podcast, you'd be sitting in front of an accountant, you know, because by trade, that would be the thing that I'd be doing. Now, maybe I'm a CFO, but trade-wise, that is the thing I'm doing. And I didn't say that. And I suppose really what, when I chose then to move into sales and then into mobile, you know, telecoms and through product and through marketing and all of that kind of stuff, those were kind of opportunistic choices. The reality is that when I was 15 or even when I was 20, the internet wasn't a thing. It was there. I mean, the internet's been around for decades, but the internet in you know, common use today was not a thing. So I didn't know that I would have an internet career, let's say, or a technology career when I was that age. And the point, I think, really is that I've always been really opportunistic. I've never been able to answer the question, you know, what do you want to do in 5 years' time? That classic kind of interview question. And, you know, the interviewer is hoping, I want to see ambition, I want to see drive. My answer has always been, maybe not to the to the interviewer, but the answer for me is always, hopefully something really interesting.
Nice.
That's what I want to be doing, is like still learning and still challenged and still engaging my brain and still, you know, and hopefully adding value, you know, in that whole exchange. But, you know, to call that navigation of a career, I think is probably giving it a little bit more credit than it's due. I think I've always been opportunistic in the things that I do next.
I love that.
Yeah. And I've discovered it hasn't always been kind of just tripping over myself. I don't want it to appear like that either. But I've always known, or I've known at least for a long time, the things that give me energy. It was early in my career, I was a project manager. That did not give me energy. That's not the kind of level of micromanagement, for want of a better way to put it, that I really enjoy. I learned a ton. It gave me, you know, a really good appreciation of structure and organization. But I didn't love it. It wasn't something that I was passionate about. And so I've been able to kind of parse out the things that are not valuable for my interest levels versus the things that are valuable for my interest levels. And I think that, to simplify it, something challenging, something difficult, something new, something that I can add to, something that I can learn from.
I think, being opportunistic is, I really resonate with that. And it feels like the way you talked about HubSpot, starting off with a core and building out things that the customers are talking about, feels like a culture that's within HubSpot. Mm. And that actually is culturally fits into the marketing industry. As like, I think marketers, like good marketers, are opportunistic. They're going, well, that hasn't been done before. Here's a way of getting to our, you know, to talk to our customers or to do a new thing. And if you've got a team that you're over that thinks like that, and you've got a product that's being built that is opportunistic, then it's going to fit beautifully into the, you know, the hands of those people that are going to use the product.
Yeah.
It makes absolute sense.
I think that with the kind of the marketing, you know, the oft maligned science and art of marketing, I think, is a really, really complex one, but a super interesting one. And marketing in the kind of broad sense, right, if you include advertising and creative and everything in there, but it's the kind of leading edge of information for companies, for businesses, for ideas. You know, there's more than a hint of psychology that goes into it, of, you know, anthropology that goes into it, understanding human behavior. Like I happened to trip upon a TV show, a documentary a few weeks ago about, you know, a chocolate bar advertisers in the 1980s in Britain, you know, and it was the kind of the Cadbury versus Roundtree, you know, or, you know, Terry's or whoever else was in the mix, you know, the kind of battle for eyeballs and for you know, and for, you know, creating interest and demand. And it was absolutely fascinating. But at its heart, I was thinking about, you know, tactically, how different is that to how we do things today? And it's really not. I mean, it's the, you know, grabbing intent and creating demand and creating interest. Those are all the same important things and, you know, appealing to those same impulses. We have different media, you know, to do that now and different ways to connect. But actually, that you know, desire to really deeply understand the psyche of the buyer, like what do they care about? Absolutely fascinating.
It's just about people, isn't it? I mean, it's interesting, really, because I hear both of your answers when we speak about the HubSpot perspective, but also the personal perspective. What I can observe in how you're speaking is like there is a core direction. You know, so for HubSpot, it's the inbound sort of methodology, the school of, etc. But for you, it's also like do something interesting. You know, and you got these North Stars, for want of a less horrible phrase, you know, which guide you, which sort of take you through these transition periods. I mean, in marketing, we would speak about these as just having a strategy, you know, like, yeah. You know, as an idea of where we're going to go and the tactics shift around it and stuff like that. And I love that because it's so easy to lose. And like, I can actually, as I hear you speak, I can feel my shoulders relaxing, you know, because it's easy to lose yourself in the idea of my job is going to look different versus I am working towards something which has a wider objective or something which is fulfilling for me as a human being that happens to work in marketing or whatever it may be. You know, we're all being told about losing our jobs, but actually, you know, there's other things, you know, other directions that we can take in that might be within the same sector, which is still interesting.
If you've got those core principles of understanding people and their needs,
exactly,
the tech just clips in, doesn't it, around how you do it.
It does, but I think you have to have a belief as well that, as an individual, that you can leave something in a better state than you found it. You know, I know certainly for me, any time that I've, or at least the most conscious decisions that I've made around joining a company or taking on a role or doing something different is not just believing, but being able to visualize where that can go, you know. And, you know, in HubSpot's case, for example, similar to, you know, the time I spent at Stripe, and from day one, but until the day I finished that role, and, you know, from day one here at HubSpot and continually, still believing that our biggest successes are still ahead of us. Yeah. You know, we have this, you know, incredible foundation, but we don't serve every customer today.
No.
You know, with the customers that we serve, we don't serve them with the full suite of capabilities we have today. Mm. There are capabilities we haven't yet imagined.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, I for me, again, you know, going back to that thing which is a motivator, I have zero interest in supervising somebody else's work or taking something and you know, just running it, if you like, operating it.
Yeah.
I'm much more interested in building something. And I think, again, that's an instinct that we have here at HubSpot is we're building for the future. When we work with our customers, we're helping them imagine what their future can be and how they can build that and what are the capabilities they haven't yet imagined.
Yeah, I love that.
Our partners, the same thing.
I came into the marketing workforce around 2014, and I was introduced to this concept of inbound. And it was only later on that I realised that that was a HubSpot thing. You know, that was things that Dharmesh and Brian, the founders, sort of spoke about and sort of coined and sort of grew. And it's funny because that became so ubiquitous as part of marketing. You know, you do inbound, and in fact, probably the largest part of marketing as a whole. Mm-hmm. But picking up on the high AI thing over here, I'm just fascinated because inbound has been the thing for forever for HubSpot. I mean, how are you speaking about that internally right now, where you're reflecting on like the changes that AI bring? For example, in search, the way that searches are brought up in ChatGPT or Perplexity or whatever, that's a big change to blog posts, for example. How do you start to think about that as a company? Because presumably it's a big shift for all of you as much as it is for all of us.
Yes. It's a big shift, I suppose, in it's a big shift in the same way for us as it is for everyone else in industry or in the world at large. I suppose the way that we think about AI, the application of AI, and again, this is one of the beauties of having a technical co-founder as well as a business-minded co-founder, is Dharmesh jumped on AI, you know, on ChatGPT day one and created ChatSpot, you know, as a, you know, hack project overnight, you know. And again, that's one of the things that I think is so critical to our current success, but also our future success, is that ultimately, we've got people who like playing with stuff and making things, and you know, bringing that value to others, and that's really where you know, Dharmesh is probably most happy. Actually, is discovering, you know, okay, this thing is super interesting. Mm-hmm. Now what? How do we apply that? How do we reason that? And our approach is really informed by that as well. You know, if you take the application of AI in HubSpot, it's native to HubSpot. How you use HubSpot is better because of AI, and some of that will be explicitly, you know, marked out for you, like, you know, with content creation or with chat assist or things like that. And some of it will just be, this tool works a lot better. It presents more insights to me in ways that I hadn't expected, mm-hmm. because it is native to the application. That's how we see it. It's not a HubSpot now with AI, you know. It's a HubSpot.
Yeah.
You know, and AI is kind of built into that. But I think there's also, while it's really important for us to appreciate the magnitude of what AI can do and what AI does, it's probably important for us to contextualize that as well. I mean, AI as we know it today, or the kind of the ChatGPT version of AI, which has, which I think has brought it to life for consumers, you know, in a way that nothing else has done before. If you think about the Google search experience today and the Google search experience 25 years ago, the Google homepage, let's take the web version for example, looks basically the same except for the logo. Right? Yeah. The logo has changed, but it's still that little box, you type in the thing. But the experience has changed immeasurably in that 25 years, and for us consuming it, almost unknowingly. Yeah. You know. That kind of predictive text, that kind of assist and suggest notion that Google kind of productized, is just like breathing air now. You know, we don't even think of it. Mm-hmm. And yet that experience is entirely transformed and continually transforming, as a race, you know, as a race which is probably difficult to calculate. Continuously. So that idea of machine learning, that idea of data-led improvement and insight and enrichment has been around for quite a long time. Mm. I think again, where AI has kind of popped its head up. You know, companies have been doing AI for decades.
Yeah, yeah.
But it really just popped its head up when we were able to kind of create weird photos as consumers. You know, as consumers, you know, or make ourselves look a little better in the kind of headshots. Like, that's where where it lands, is when people feel us in their daily lives. And so I think while there is, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, we shouldn't overstate the magnitude of this too much.
That's great stuff. I mean,
so yeah, I'm glad you positioned it in that way, because I hadn't really thought of it like that. I was going to challenge you on, like, as somebody who's got an account management background. So I don't know what the age difference is, but we maybe we've had 47. Okay, so 43 next month. This month, crikey. And I spent my 20s driving all over the country, going and having coffees with people. We'd get faxes as orders. So everything was built around people and relationships. And there's the older person in me that sees AI and worries that actually it becomes something that removes us from that personal connection, because everything is so automated and so immediate and so data-led that they become a ticket as opposed to a person.
Yeah.
I think you've already kind of touched on the fact that AI is, the way it's being built, is better than replacing a human. It's actually just subtly coming in and supporting you. Is that kind of where you're going with it?
Yes, totally. I think, you know, the practical application of AI is already embedded in stuff that we do now. And the more deliberate and intentional application of us, as we're doing in HubSpot, and we're enabling our own teams by using our own technology, what we're doing with that is we're making the human experience a better experience. You know, we're making the time spent. As an account manager, you driving around the country and faxing in stuff, you know, and maybe spending time going through the telephone directory for numbers. Like, you would never contemplate doing any of that time-wasting stuff anymore. And yes, you know, most salespeople spend less than 30 or 40% of their time talking to customers. They spend more of their time doing admin, you know. Even if they're not driving around the country and spending their time in their car, they're probably spending their time at their desk frustrated with some data challenge, you know. And AI solves that and gives time to that person to be more productive and be more effective and focus actually on those human connections.
That you couldn't have said a more perfect answer for me, because there's this, as I say, slightly older guy that's the skeptic that kind of goes, oh, I kind of don't like all this. Like, I've got an app for everything, and you know, I haven't even got a piece of paper. I've got something that looks like paper, and I romanticize about old-fashioned relationships and that sort of thing. But what you're saying is that actually I can do more of that. I can actually spend more time with my customers, having a cup of coffee, than going, oh, geez, I've got to go through that database and work out, like, wait, when was that conversation? Or I wrote something on a bit of paper somewhere, and, you know, and actually it becomes, it's an enabler as opposed to something that replaces what you do.
Yeah, but it's important, too, to think, like, to remember, like, we would be kidding ourselves if we thought, you know, I've done that roadshow as well, that gig as well, you know, we'd be kidding ourselves if we thought that the way we showed up to customers 20 years ago is the appropriate way to still do it today, because the customers are consumers as well. The buyers are consumers as well. When you interact with a travel website or a retailer or a technology company, the prospect of having to wait for somebody to answer the phone or to go into the shop, it's like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
I'm not doing that. You know, actually what I want is just give me the answer fast. If I can speak it into my phone and have it, you know, played back to me, that's the preferred experience. So, and as consumers, we're all doing jobs. Some of us may be buying software as part of our job, or you know, running a company as part of our job, or leading a team. And so to suggest that we need to flip our personal preferences to some other orientation, some outdated business orientation of how people like to buy, is a fool's errand. You know, we need to be thinking about our buyers, our customers, in the same way as we think about our personal preferences. And by the way, this spans the demographic, right? I think you're more likely as an over 55s person to have a lower tolerance for human interaction. Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is actually, you know, even I think about my parents, they've embraced technology in ways that they would never have imagined before, because it's the way to go. You know, they'd never contemplate walking into the bank or into the travel agent or even into the retailer for certain things anymore, because that's hassle.
Yeah. My dad watches more YouTube than, I swear, like a teenage, you know.
It staggers me. Like, my dad's in his mid-70s, and I was talking about a YouTube channel that I thought he'd have no idea about. And he's like, oh yeah, I watch Matt Armstrong. I was like, what?
It is funny, you sort of roll with that. It's fascinating. You mentioned your team as part of your answer there, and I wanted to pick up on that, because I think you've already done a bit of this in when we've been chatting today. But the narrative around these sort of shifts and the future of marketing and stuff like that, it's as fear-inducing as it is exciting. And maybe I'm speaking from a personal perspective. Maybe everyone's really excited and I'm just scared. I don't know. But how do you begin to speak with your team around the stuff that we've spoken about today? You know, these changes that are happening in the industry, and you've got all these external sources yammering in their ear. You know, how do you sort of excite people about what's coming forward and sort of get them to adopt them and try these things out and be creative with it and stuff like that?
It might be a disappointing answer insofar as, like, we're working with tech natives, you know. We have everybody working here is au fait with technology, is using it as consumers in their daily lives. And so the prospect of their job being easier because this thing does the thing that they don't like doing is more exciting than not. You're more likely to be met with, can we have it now?
Yeah.
Like, can we go faster now?
Yeah.
You know, and that's everyone from sales, you know, reps to customer service and customer success managers and marketeers. Everyone is excited and, you know, anticipating this kind of change. Mm-hmm. You know, technology shifts, like, go back to the printing press, right? You know, I mean, sure, there were people who were handwriting documents who felt, oh no, the printing press is going to stop me doing this work. Go do something more interesting. Build printing presses, right? Like, what those shifts in technology actually do is create opportunity. And again, even to boil it down to its most simplistic, if I'm a frustrated salesperson who only gets to spend 3 hours out of 10 talking to customers, help me do five hours out of 10, I will bite your hand off for that.
Is that something that culturally is within HubSpot, is about moving fast? Because I guess you've got, there are other CRMs available, I'm sure. I'm not sure who they are, but let's say there are. That you are, is it important to be first to the gate, or is it more important to make sure that HubSpot's stuff is better, even if you're, you know, 6 months behind the competition?
Well, you never like to be behind, but it's probably both of those things. You know, it's probably be first, but be there when there's an opportunity. And, you know, being first, you don't have to be first for everything. This is not a unique HubSpot thing. You know, like, when pioneers get shot, you know, settlers, you know, find gold, you know. So
that's the other hook.
You know, so being first for its own sake is not a goal. Being fast, I think, is an imperative, right? We're a business like every other. You have to be fast because, you know, Matt Britton from Google used to say, as fast is better than slow, right? Again, it's a pretty clarifying statement. If you're going slowly, then you're probably missing some kind of opportunity. So, being fast is important, and being fast and sometimes being first is important, is important if that's what customers, current customers or prospective customers, need and expect.
Yeah. I think I kind of picked up on the speed thing through Joel Laugh, because I always listen to a podcast called My First Million, which is part of the HubSpot network. And when they became part of the HubSpot network, I was then very aware of like others that were becoming part of it. And I was like, huh, that's a really smart play. And that's something that you have to be, I guess you have to be quite quick internally to go, let's acquire that, because if we don't, someone else could. And you almost get, and it feels like you've gone on a bit of a mission to go, right, where are the popular ones? Where are our audience? Who? How can we leverage this?
Yeah.
And I have to say as well, I think whoever's in control of how they're positioned after being acquired has done a great job, because it doesn't feel like, you know, the MFM guys are going HubSpot, HubSpot, HubSpot. I mean, that's obviously the only brand they now talk about, but it's done in such a native way that I'm like, I still really enjoy this podcast. It hasn't changed. Yeah. So you've done a great job in like not disrupting that and going, actually, we're going to make you sound like HubSpot now. It's like, you be you, but we're just going to like piggyback onto that. And I, that was kind of where I thought, you know, speed must be a thing.
Yeah, I mean, it is really important. I think, you know, if you're going to make a decision to move into an area or acquire a business or build a particular capability, the decision has to be a deliberate, you know, decision and a careful decision. And we have a responsibility to our customers that the decisions we're making are going to be valuable to their customers. And that is at the heart of it. Like, where is the value in these decisions that we'll make or these investments that we'll make? Does that value go to customers immediately or over time? Does it go somewhere else where maybe it's necessary and will ultimately facilitate customers? But that is ultimately the drive behind us is customers. You know, without those customers, without them getting value from that network, without them getting value from the partners we work with, without them getting value from every interaction they have with somebody here, we then need to start thinking about, okay, are those the right investments?
Yeah.
That's super interesting.
I find this a lot when we speak to, you know, I'm trying to blow smoke here, but more senior folks, you know, in organisations, the ease at which they speak about the customers relentlessly, you know, and have that curiosity about the folks. I mean, I think it's a great lesson for marketers in general. I mean, with the marketing meetup community, we'll have folks who are right on the spectrum of, like myself, when I started my marketing career on an industrial estate on the outside of Newmarket in a three-person company, you know, all the way through to the CMO of Deliveroo or whatever, you know, there's a wide spectrum. But I remember, particularly at the beginning stages of my career, being asked to phone up my customers, you know, and it was for a conferencing company called Business of Software. And as a digital native, I was terrified, you know, like to pick up the phone and sort of say, you know, did you enjoy the conference? Do you want to come back next year? You know, and sort of have that thing. It was a far more comfortable place to make a graphic, post it on social media, probably get a couple of likes, maybe add another couple of people to the newsletter or whatever it may be. You know, that felt like a far more comfortable place. And so I just think it's just such an interesting, relevant point to sort of be reminded to go out to folks, you know, to have those conversations, to be curious about their worlds and the sort of, it feels endlessly worthy as a takeaway from this session, you know. So
I think if you're building a company or a proposition or a product or an idea, you're doing it for someone. You're doing it for some stakeholder, you're doing it for some audience. And at the start, you might be super clear on who that audience is. And over time, then that audience might expand. But you can't. And data, by the way, is a great indicator of where audiences and customers want you to take them or want to take you. But there's no replacement for conversation. You know, there's tens of thousands of years of human evolution, you know, will demonstrate that, you know, that conversation, that connection. Because in those conversations, those connections, those hallway chats, you can learn more than maybe a targeted, hey, let's talk about this. Okay, I'm in lane, I'm talking about this. Yeah. I'm not thinking about anything else. And so it's almost, you want to be able to create moments as well for customers where those involuntary conversations happen.
Yeah. It's serendipity, isn't it?
It is serendipity.
It's kind of why we do our, we've got, was it something like 130, 140 in-person events this year. And they're not particularly profitable, but we kind of, we don't care because you can't replicate that magic.
I think that is a really important part of us. Humanity has to be part of what you do in the same way as purpose needs to be part of what you do. If there's no purpose, then I can't motivate you out of bed to drive through the snow to come to work or on a sunny day.
You know? We got you here.
But without that purpose, you know, there's no reason to do the thing, you know, and humanity is often at the core of that purpose. We're doing it for some part of humanity, you know. And it's not only valuable, it's critical to have a North Star. It's critical to have something that you go after, some purpose that you go after, because otherwise you forget why you're there. Like that what you mentioned there a second ago, we do 130, 140 meetups, they're probably not profitable. You might not have a profitability challenge, you have an attribution challenge. Mm-hmm. You know, those events themselves are not maybe paying you back immediately. But where else are they paying back? Where are they paying you back somewhere else? Where are they paying that network?
Yeah.
So that network now becomes more powerful for you. You know, those are the kind of intangible marketing things. You know, 50% of my marketing works, 50% of it doesn't. I just don't know which. But those things are for the two people, if no one else in those meetups, that was an invaluable opportunity.
Yeah. And we know it happens at every single meetup, every single time. In the same way that when I was out repping years ago, I knew that if I visited six house builders in a day, I didn't know what conversations I was going to have, but I know that there would be some serendipity in there that, you know, I'd bump into a marketing director or I'd learn something about the business that, you know, they've kind of, I wouldn't have learned in any other way. Super interesting.
It's wonderful. I think it's, you know, we normally sort of penned the theme of today to be the future of marketing, you know, sort of walking in here and, you know, being very aware that the conversation might take us to different places. But I think it's interesting that sort of everything changes, but everything stays the same, you know, and there's something really quite reassuring and lovely and you know, hopefully encouraging to our community, you know, folks who can sort of go around and A, know they're not alone with these things, but then B, sort of, you know, there's some excitement to be had, some reassurance.
That's just the bit where you look at the camera and say, it's going to be okay, folks. Everything's going to be fine. Let's keep going.
Another hook. But this was the number one question that we had at the beginning, which was, if you could jam with any rock star, past, present, future, well, probably not future, that'll be hard.
Yeah.
Who would it be?
It's future AI.
Yeah.
I want AI to make my songs better.
Auto-tuned.
Oh, it's a great question. It's one of those things as well. It depends on the day you catch me.
Okay.
I would love to jam with Phil Lynott from Thin Lizzy.
Okay, nice.
I would love to jam with Freddie Mercury. And Brian May, actually, from Queen. When I started playing guitar, I wanted to be Slash from Guns N' Roses, nice. So I wouldn't mind catching up with him.
Yeah.
James Hetfield from Metallica, wouldn't mind catching up with him either. This is a theme here, right? There's rock music through and through. Yeah.
Nice, I love that. I'm imagining a thumbnail with Slash hair on.
With guns with the bandana.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Welcome to the Jungle is one of those, you know how like you have a few tracks that if you need to get pepped up before, like, I mean, I'm a middle-aged guy driving an estate Volvo, but like, I don't give a shit. Like, guns are little...
There's very little, actually, that can kind of get you revved up like a really good song. That's a fantastic intro. There's such a build to it.
Yeah.
No One Knows by Queens of the Stone Age is a great one to get you started as well.
So, yeah.
Let's check that out. See, Thunderstruck is my... okay. So on the way to boot camp, that's me, you know, like...
That's awesome.
In my Skoda.
Living the dream, brother. Living the dream. Yeah. But thank you.
Not at all.
It's really like, what an interesting job you have. An interesting life.
It is one of those things, isn't it? Like the cliche of, you know, do what you love and you never work a day in your life. Like, I'm incredibly fortunate. I've always, even in the career mistakes that I've made, and they are mistakes, you know, objectively speaking, without those mistakes, the other opportunities wouldn't have presented themselves.
100%. Yeah, I feel exactly the same.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.